got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Cameron and Kevin back for another episode. Kevin, how are you today?
Doing absolutely swimmingly. How about you?
I don't know about swimmingly. Maybe terrific. Splendid, perhaps.
I'm not even sure what swimmingly means. I'm not swimming.
Maybe you're just going with the flow, so to speak. I don't know. No one tells me nothing. Anyways, we've got some great stories I don't know if great's the right word. Interesting stories, let's say, to go over with you guys today. But first up, our genes could affect our susceptibility to COVID-19, but how big of an impact are we talking about? Anti-vaccine group Children's Health Defense claims the elite are using the pandemic to usher in global government. Meanwhile, a virologist and biotech expert says the coronavirus is a warning to embrace agricultural technology. And finally, some anti-GMO groups allege that Bayer's herbicide Roundup is at least partially to blame for the pandemic. So we're going to go into what evidence they might have for this theory. But first up, Kevin, let's talk about the possibility of our genetics making us vulnerable to coronavirus. And this is, I want to say, Loic Mangan in Scientific American.
Oh, that's cool. I never saw an umlaut on an I.
So, I know, I'm confused.
So really, the question that really has come up is, why is there such a broad spectrum of outcomes with respect to COVID-19 infection? And when you start seeing different people, you know, of course, there's a gradient of age, you know, more severity with age, that kind of thing, comorbidities playing a major role. But even within similar classes of comorbidities or lack of comorbidities, there still is a spectrum of outcomes and a spectrum of different presentations of symptoms. And it turns out that men are 73% of severe COVID-19 cases. So something to do with maleness. Okay. So, you know, blame the guys again. But there's a couple examples of why that may be. And the article talks about some of these effects that really help to put a mechanism on why men may be more susceptible, but also some of the other genetic factors that may make one more predisposed to severity of infection.
So one of the examples they give is the fact that women have two X chromosomes, and so they carry two copies of a specific gene that boosts their immunity. Can you talk a little bit more about how that works and how we know that?
Well, sure. Women carry two X chromosomes and males just one. Males have an X and a Y. So you got a Y from your dad and an X from your mom. Females got an X from mom and an X from dad. There's a gene on the X chromosome called TLR7. And TLR7 is one of a type of receptor on immune cells called a toll-like receptor, TLR, toll-like receptor. And these are present in the cells associated with first wave of immunity. So dendritic cells, macrophages, natural killer cells, leukocytes, they all are loaded with TLR7. And what the idea here is that if you have an X chromosome and a Y and you're a guy versus two X's, you have potential for what geneticists refer to as a dosage effect, that you're able to say, okay, one X chromosome can produce this much information through the standard processes of transcription and translation. If you have two X chromosomes, you can double that. And so that's kind of the rationale behind that kind of logic, that because men have half the number of these genes, that there's half the gene expression and half the protection from this particular type of gene.
Now, one of the other things they mentioned is that it could be partially due to behavioral and hormonal differences between men and women. how is that in the context of an infectious disease? You know, what kind of behaviors might one gender be engaged in that the other isn't, that either boosts or decrease their risk for contracting this?
Yeah, I think it dials back to underlying hormonal differences that may be associated with specific behaviors, but I don't know that the behavior makes you more likely to become infected. I mean, I guess it could, you know, if you're more of a risk taker, someone who's willing to go out without a mask or lick doorknobs or stuff like that. But I think it has more to do with how hormones prime and change the way genes are expressed. And it could be that when men and different, or between men and women, or between women and women, or different people in a population, different levels of different hormones could prime the physiology and ultimately, you know, the immune response to be able to meet some sort of threat. And so that's probably what they're referring to.
Now, they give several examples, like the ones we've already talked about. And my question to you is, how certain are we about this? Because as we've talked about, this stuff is evolving in real time. And so is this a situation where they're assigning a probability to people who have particular genetic markers, or have they actually done the research to show, you know, if you have this gene, this is the mechanism by which your risk is increased?
No, I think you're right. It's just unfolding as it's happening. But I think what the article is highlighting is the fact that there is such a variation in the presentation of symptoms that maybe there are underlying genetic determinants. And so looking at, we know that the virus interacts with the ACE2 receptor in the lungs and in other tissues in the body. And there are different variants of the ACE2 receptor. And when you look at people's severity, you find these different variants associated with degree of severity of infection. And so even though you can't say at this point definitively, these trends are emerging and they're exciting because they tell us maybe how the virus is functioning, how it's mechanistically interacting with cells. And when you know that, you can start to design drugs a little bit better and be a little more specific in therapies. So these are really important trends to be watching, and I'm glad epidemiologists are looking at that.
Okay, so it's good news then. It's helping us fine tune our response to this. So that's good news. And not so good news, though, we have anti-vax groups who say the elite are using COVID-19 to usher in a techno-communist global government. Now, this is an article that I wrote for GLP, so I'm curious to get your take on it, Kevin, reading it as a scientist, but as an outsider, because I obviously have a little bit of bias having written this.
Well, and that's kind of why, you know, I thought this would be a good one for us to cover, is because here anti-vaccine groups are really seizing the opportunity, and that's kind of a theme among a couple stories here today, is the anti-blank groups are seizing upon a national emergency and a pandemic to really forward their agenda by referring to the disease as part of an agenda. You know, so this group, Children's Health Defense, which, you know, I never really looked much at their website before until today. And, you know, it's pretty much the same old stuff. But they're relatively convinced that because the Gates Foundation and Johns Hopkins and other organizations have had pandemic preparedness tests in the last few years, like they've done some drills and done some discussions, had a conference about pandemic preparedness, that, aha, there's the smoking gun. They were preparing for this because if they can get everybody infected, then it forwards the immunization agenda to get everybody immunized. And what better way to do it than to scare everybody with a scary disease, right?
Right, right. It's a very compelling story for sure. But there's a few things that popped out to me as I was reading this on their website. And the first is that it makes sense to prepare for a pandemic, especially for a coronavirus pandemic, because the way they frame it is like, see, we're in a pandemic right now, and they were looking at coronaviruses last October, you know. But in reality, I think we've talked about this on the show, but there are 7 coronaviruses now, and we know 3 of them can kill humans. And so at the time they knew about two. And so it makes perfect sense that you would try to figure out how you would react to a virus like this spreading around the world. And I remember now we mentioned back in 2007, researchers were warning about a coronavirus pandemic as a possibility. So all that to say, it makes sense. You know, I think the conspiracy framing is the problem here.
Yeah, that's all it is. And it's a it's seizing upon this particular emergency to further distrust in the system they dislike. So the anti-vaxxers don't like vaccination. Vaccination will be a key part of the COVID-19 healing process. So coming out of the pandemic will occur as more people either become sick and we start to achieve herd immunity, or we can have herd immunity by immunization. And no one doubts that. And I think if you're an anti-vaxxer and you see that on the wall, that a vaccine will come and eradicate this problem, well, or severely decrease this problem, that means donations to, you know, children's health defense are going to go down because people are going to see the man behind the curtain as they're rolling up their sleeve to get the vaccine that that they previously said they would never get. So, you know, this is their house of cards is crumbling. So expect them to ramp up the rhetoric in this particular area.
And lest you think that Kevin or I have been bought off by Big Pharma, I want to let you guys know, and I linked this in the article, but there's video of this conference that Johns Hopkins University hosted back in October. It's about 3 hours long, and I sat through a bunch of it as I was writing the article, and I almost fell asleep because it's so boring. There's nothing in there that would suggest that, you know, there's the secret cabal and they're trying to take over the world. They talk about things like, how do we get ventilators from one continent to the other? And how do we ramp up production of masks? And how do we develop treatments? And how do we develop vaccines for a novel virus like this? They're all very prescient questions that we should have been looking at. And, you know, the ironic part in all this is that we didn't heed this advice. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that, and if you're going to have a top secret cabal, it's best not to have it as a nationally advertised conference that is available on YouTube. You know, so and it kind of goes against the idea of this being some, you know, underground clandestine conspiracy. It seems to be out in the sunshine, and to point a finger at it and call it a you know, what did they call it, a communist, neo-communist, techno-communist global government, yeah. You know.
Techno-communist global government.
All right. Yeah. Well, that sounds wonderful.
It sounds like a great name for like a death metal band, though. I might pick it up for that if they don't sue me for it. But one thing I wanted to add, and I mentioned this in the last bit of the article, I think the real conspiracy theory would have been if the people with the resources and the influence to do nothing as a new virus started spreading across the world, you know, if they didn't get involved and they didn't try to encourage people to get immunizations or try to develop a vaccine, that would be truly evil. You know what I mean? That would be the conspiracy worth calling out. But, and maybe this makes me a gullible shill, but if Bill Gates wants to donate a bunch of money to the development of a vaccine, then God bless him. You know what I mean?
No, exactly. It's the same thing. You know, it's easy to, you know, say, call something a conspiratorial scam to sell vaccines. But, you know, here is a group of people, you know, I hate when people go after Gates because the guy gives away more money than anybody and tries to solve important problems. And he's getting it right a lot of times. For them to go after him is really low. This is just everybody doing their best to solve a problem as it unfolds. And to call it out so your organization can profit is really low.
Yeah, I don't think there's much argument there. And just one final point before we move on. Civil liberties are important, and I think people should take that seriously. And they shouldn't cede their individual freedom for nothing, you know what I mean? But I think when we're talking about vaccines, we're not talking about anybody infringing on your right. We're just talking about you not coughing on someone and, you know, potentially killing them. So I think that's an important distinction. You know, be concerned about those issues, but don't wrap it up into this grand conspiracy.
Well, let me throw one more thing in on that, because this was something I wrote about today, in a way, because I've seen so many, you know, macho guy dudes without masks and a lot of complaints about you're taking my freedoms. And people say the same thing about vaccination. It's not taking away your freedom. It's asking you to take a small sacrifice to participate in society, that to protect others, you make this little sacrifice. And it's not an infringement on your freedom. You know, the kind of argument I made was, you know, 18-year-olds were asked to give up their freedom and their liberty and their basically the first part of their lives, handed a gun and told to go fight Nazis. You know, they made that sacrifice because it was the right thing to do for a national effort. That is a sacrifice. You certainly can wear a mask to the CVS. You know, it's not taking away your freedoms and your liberties. It's asking you to do something to participate, to protect others. And, you know, I feel really strong about this because where I live, I'm not seeing a whole lot of compliance.
Yeah. You know, maybe this is a topic we should revisit to really dive into the political aspect of this, or at least the policy aspect, not to get partisan on it, but it's an important topic. But let's leave it there for now. And let's talk about this. This is another article, another original for GLP. And this is called COVID-19 Food Shortages: Why the Pandemic is a Warning to Embrace Agricultural Technology. And this is by a virologist that just started writing for us, named Maria Rocha. And I love this article, but Kevin, this is right up your alley. So why don't you jump in?
Yeah, well, the article itself is something that I would urge people to read because it covers a lot of real estate. But the basic idea is that, you know, we took the snow globe, we put it in the paint shaker, and we're seeing a major change in the way things will be done. And when you start to, and I'm really just summarizing the whole article without getting into the specifics, when they talk about the potential of a food crisis, when you have workers that can't get across borders, when you see breakdowns in supply chain, you start to see the vulnerabilities of a food system or food systems that allow us to have access to abundant and cheap produce, and that we don't and the other nice thing she said was that when we see people having medical problems, we don't go to good intentions and prayers to solve those problems. At least most of us don't. We go to medicine and turn to science. And so it's time for agriculture to turn to science to solve the problem. And that includes using genetic engineering as one of the tools to solve the problem.
One thing she said that I found very, very interesting, referencing the Green Revolution, is she said that it produced so much food on such a massive scale that we started thinking, well, we have so much food, we just need to get it around the world and we don't have to worry about production anymore. And I think in many ways, that's one of the foundational arguments that the anti-biotech crowd likes to talk about today. And so it's ironic in the sense that, you know, it was innovation and technology that seeded some serious doubts about innovation and technology and food production. I just find that fascinating.
Yeah, me too. And I always hate that argument because it really is very ethnocentric to imply that people around the world will want to eat the same thing that we produce, especially stuff we produce in mass for livestock, you know, primarily. You know, what does that say when we're going to say, we're going to give you all the field corn you can eat? You know, it's really kind of insulting. If we really care about people around the world, we should assist them and enable them to implement technologies to work on the crops that they use culturally and socially, the crops that are part of their culture. You know, that's where we need to be with this. And that means ramping up technology and not worrying about, you know, all of this, well, it's just distribution of calories. It's not that. It's about using technology to empower people to eat what they want to eat. And I think that's the most important lesson.
Yeah, yeah, without a doubt. And to follow up on the point you made about, you know, culturally relevant foods, there are, and you know this much better than I do, Kevin, but there are breeding programs and there are research programs based in countries like Nigeria and Uganda, and they're trying to develop enhanced crops that are popular in those countries or that are very important economically. And you have these groups from the West coming into town and saying, no, 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 you don't want this because it'll give you cancer. I think that's the most defensive part, is that you want countries to develop. I mean, they want it, of course, but looking at this from the outside, you don't want countries around the world that are dependent upon handouts to survive. That's just not a good place for the world to be.
Yeah, give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Hand a guy a bunch of really cool molecular biology reagents in a laboratory, and he'll do really fun stuff for the rest of his life. That's what's on my license plate frame. But this is the idea. How do we enable people around the world, scientists around the world, governments around the world, to take charge in feeding their own people? You know, it's so heady of us to say, we will feed you, we will come as the saviors and help you out. You know, that's so lame. It's good for us to foster the development of technology so that others can do what they want to do in their own context and be the heroes inside their own countries. And I really love that and really hope that is more and more the case going forward.
Amen. Well, speaking of people who have very oddball ideas about agriculture, let's talk about this article from from Joe Schwartz at McGill University. And he's talking about MIT computer scientist Stephanie Seneff, who is not blaming the pandemic on glyphosate exclusively, but she's saying that this active ingredient in Bayer's Roundup weed killer is perhaps largely responsible for the COVID-19 symptoms that we're seeing, perhaps after people get infected with the virus. So jump in here, Kevin. I don't know what to say except to bash my head on the table.
It is a continuation of the madness that only gets madder. And Dr. Seneff, for years now, she's a computer scientist who works at MIT, who has made outrageous claims regarding genetically engineered crops and particularly the chemical glyphosate, which is, as far as scientists have claimed, one of the safest agricultural chemicals of all time and has very little collateral demonstration of effects. Yet she has said this is contributing to Alzheimer's, to thyroid problems, to autism. In every single problem you can think of, she says this is all based on glyphosate. And she's done a good job of resting on this affiliation with MIT. So I was at a something that she presented at where she would say, in my laboratory at MIT, we have done the research that shows, it's like, you don't have a laboratory, you got a computer, and you know, your laboratory is Google, you know, and she would make these statements and people would be gasping, like, oh my God, this is horrible. You mean 50% of kids are going to have autism, or like 100% of kids will have autism by 2025? And I think she said that in 2014, and we're halfway there. And I can't wait till we're in 2025. I hope she's still around where we can revisit this. But this article that she wrote really spins out. And what she says is that COVID-19 and the respiratory parts of it are due to glyphosate, which was sprayed on corn, and the corn was made into ethanol, and the ethanol went into gasoline, and gasoline was put in the trucks, and when you drove down the road, you created exhaust fumes that contained glyphosate that then you breathe in and you get COVID-19.
That makes perfect sense to me and sounds airtight, Kevin. So maybe you're...
I mean, this is like the total, like, you know, red string and pin thumbtacks on the corkboard, you know, like 6 degrees of separation here. Because it was about, her main evidence was that the Mars, that Robert and Elizabeth Marr, the two people who died in Seattle,
Washington.
Yeah, they're both in their 70s. And she said, here's the smoking gun. The restaurant that they owned was just a few blocks away from an 8-lane superhighway. And so they were breathing in exhaust fumes, and that's what happened. And then she would talk about how the Yangtze River in China is polluted from agricultural runoff, and that's why Wuhan, you know, is right on the banks of the Yangtze, so that's why they had problems. And then she would say, look, in the United States, you know, we have rivers and all that glyphosate ends up in the water. And so if you look at the worst hit cities, New York, New Orleans, Seattle, they're all right on water, and water is full of glyphosate. Aha! So this is the part that just blows me away, is like these super tenuous connect the dots, you know, and then when they asked her about Italy, you know, Italy doesn't have GE crops. So, you know, and she said, yeah, but they grow olives and they use glyphosate in the olive field. So there you go.
Gotcha. Well, let me ask this. And this is what's so strange to me is that until recently, I drove on I-5 almost every day because I'm out here in California. I use an electronic cigarette, which she also complains about because that allegedly has glyphosate too. It doesn't, but, you know, regardless. And I've never been to China, but I live right on the American River, again, out here in Northern California. So presumably, I should have had all these symptoms years ago because I was exposed to all the sources that she complains about. So I think that's a pretty telltale sign, and not just me personally, right? That applies to millions of people, what I just described. So, I mean, it's convenient that this happened as soon as we identified a new coronavirus.
Well, she, you know, for her, her star was sinking a little bit because all of her predictions never come true. And she puts these things in peer-reviewed journals at times that are really super low quality. And she had some in one of them. I can't even remember the name of it now. But it's a journal that is like a theoretical physics journal. And they got so much hassle for publishing a completely crazy article, kind of a predatory journal, that even they put a disclaimer up like, yeah, we don't know about this.
So even the predatory journal was like, we don't know.
Yeah,
yeah,
the predator did not want to prey on this particular one.
Well,
this prey is tainted. There's nothing good to consume here. When the predatory journals are backing off away from you, you know there's something wrong.
Right. Well, and I think even other people that are in this kind of anti-biotech movement, they do have a handful of scholars that kind of give an intellectual gloss to this movement. And I think even people like that, like I think Michael Antonui might be the best example. He's a geneticist at Cambridge, I think. But even they're like, this NF character is a little off the rails. So let's avoid her. Just to put this in context, is that the people who ostensibly agree with her are saying, you know, just ignore what she says.
Yeah, there's been plenty of that. There's when the anti-GMO movement is eating its own, it's pretty indicative because even guys like Antonio he's at King's College in London. Even when he starts backing away, you know that something's pretty weird. So it is the typical example of. And people say, oh, I hate the term anti-science. This is anti-science. It's taking a conclusion, glyphosate causes every disease known to humans, and then going through and cherry-picking the data to build an argument to support your conclusion. It's exactly the opposite of how science works. And yet she does it. She's a darling of the anti-vaccination movement, a darling of the anti-GMO movement, of the darling of the anti-glyphosate movement, and probably not really well regarded at MIT. They put up with a lot of heat because she says these things, and I'm glad people speak up about that. You know, when MIT speaks, people should listen. And to, you know, they're a land grant institution. Most people don't know that. And to have somebody there who's creating noise and really detracting from the gravity of their important work, something that we should all be alarmed about.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I just, in closing, you know, I think the biggest point is that, you know, the clearest explanation is that this is an infectious disease that we've identified. We know that it spreads between people, and we have a pretty good idea of where it originated. And so you don't even need this whole glyphosate thing. So for all the reasons you just described, it doesn't make any sense. You know, you can stretch a theory and tie all these loose ends together, but it's not convincing unless you go into it saying, I know this is true. Let me find the facts. You know what I mean?
No, exactly. You know, your mouth to her ears.
Yeah, well, I'm sure she listens to this podcast, as all you guys can, at geneticliteracyproject.org. So maybe we'll get a comment from Dr. Seneff.
I don't think so. I what has happened in the past is that if I ever was critical of her, her husband writes a letter to the university and complains about me, and then I have a harsh talking to from the vice president. And it's happened before. He's a graduate of where I am, university where I work, and gets a little bit upset when we criticize her. But you know, he's a scientist at MIT. And so it's one of these situations where, you know, all you have to do is call out bad science, and you start getting in the crosshairs of the people who don't want you to talk about bad science. So there you go.
Well, for those people that do want to hear you talk about good science, Kevin, tell us a little bit about what's going on in Talking Biotech in the next week or so.
Yeah, well, in Talking Biotech podcast, we're continuing our focus on COVID-19. And we've been talking about the epidemiology. We've been talking about the social effects and what's happening at grocery stores, talking about some of the widespread food shortages and other issues that are looming. I've got a lot of really great guests and people who you recognize from social media, folks like Leah McGrath, Vance Crowe, a whole bunch of other folks who have been incredible interviews. So I really hope that you can join at talkingbiotechpodcast.com or at iTunes, where we're the number 17 podcast in the life sciences. That's pretty cool.
Dang. Can I have your autograph?
No.
Oh my goodness. No, but seriously, go check out Talking Biotech. We just featured one of your more recent episodes about a Manhattan Project for a coronavirus vaccine, which is really, really insightful. So go check that out. And then, as I said, geneticliteracyproject.org for this podcast. And then on Twitter, I'm at Cam J. English. And Kevin, what's your handle?
At Kevin Falta.
Very good. Well, we will see you guys next week. Thank you so much for listening in.